CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 103, with Dr. Greg Parkhurst, building a refractive surgery practice from the ground up. Now, this is a great topic. We all dream about this, right? We could be our own boss, work for ourselves. But how do you start? How do you build a practice? This podcast will tell you an amazing story of how Greg did this. What he's built in 12 years is mind-blowing, and I'm so proud of his success, and I want you to be able to emulate that and make your own big success. Now, we're going to have a new podcast coming up very shortly. It's going to include the business of ophthalmology. It's Retina Rounds. So RetinaRounds.com, we already have a new retina video every single day. Check out the YouTube channel, subscribe to the daily email at RetinaRounds.com, but we're also going to have a business-related podcast. So it'll be episodes from the Retina Rounds podcast that are going to be about business topics in ophthalmology. You're going to learn a lot. You're going to love it. And our guest host there, Dr. Pradeep Prasad, is an expert at this with an MBA mid-career. And so he's going to teach you all those valuable lessons. So let's get on with the fun show here with Dr. Greg Parkhurst. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. Today, I have a very special guest. I got Dr. Greg Parkhurst, who started an amazing practice from nothing. And I want to get into the whole story of, how did you do all this? How did you build this empire? So welcome to our podcast.
Well, thanks, Uday, for having me. And I've loved following your journey as well with Cataract Coach. This thing's amazing. So I'm happy to be here and participate today.
Yeah, we've had a lot of fun with Cataract Coach. Now, I got to admit, man, you've done so much and you don't have any gray hair. I'm looking, you got no gray hair.
No gray hair yet. Although, you know, my wife and I have been married for 23 years now. Wow. And she likes to tell the story that she knew me before I had any chest hair. And I do actually have a couple of gray chest hairs. I won't show you them, but that's okay, where
we'll pass on those for now. But now tell us your journey in ophthalmology. So how'd you get interested in ophthalmology? How did this all start? Where'd you go to med school? Where's your training? Tell me.
So, you know, I was that kid at 9 years old. When somebody asked me, what are you going to do when you grow up someday? I said, I'm going to be an eye doctor.
At nine.
So I grew up with bad eyes. I had myopia. So, you know, I had to go to the optometrist, get glasses all the time. I absolutely hated my glasses as a kid. Yeah. But I really liked my eye doctors. I grew up in a pretty small town and the eye doctors sponsored our little league baseball team. And I was like, you know what? These guys in the community, they're cool. Looks like they've got a pretty fun job. And so they, you know, my own doctors were kind of, you know, what turned me on to, I want to do that someday. And then I just followed the path all the way through. So, you know, even when I went to college, I was immediately pre-med and started volunteering with an ophthalmologist, you know, as a sophomore in college.
Wow, really?
And he took me on a mission trip to Mexico. And, you know, we're doing M6 cataract surgery. And of course, at that time, I was just a college student. So I was just assisting handing instruments.
Sure.
But that's what really solidified and hooked me that, you know, this is going to be my path. You know, being able to see grandparents, you know, oftentimes in the developing world, you know, these older patients with, you know, severe blinding cataracts bring their whole family, you know, to the clinic. They'll be waiting in line usually for a long time. And then, you know, the next morning you get to pull that patch down and sometimes witness a grandparent see their grandchild's face for the first time. I mean, you know, they've held them before. They've of course spoken to them. They've heard their voice, but they've never seen their face. And to be able to witness that is quite a miracle. And so, you know, my mentor in college kind of showed me that, like, look, this is an incredible field, and you can have an incredible impact. And so then I knew, yep, I was right when I was nine. Ophthalmology's it for me.
Now, I read a story about you, too, though. When you were a kid, you went to some kid's birthday party, and you were they were all going to go jet skiing or something, and then your glasses fell to the bottom of the lake. Well, tell me the story.
Derek Feltman. Derek Feltman was a real great kid in my class in junior high, and you know, he was super popular because his family had a boat, and okay. So he was hosting a birthday party, and I was one of the boys that got invited. And everybody got to water ski, and I loved to water ski, still do, but as a kid, that was one of my favorite things to do. But of course, I had my glasses on, and so when it was my turn to jump in the lake to go skiing, I forgot to take my glasses off and dove in, and there went to the bottom of the lake my glasses. I remember trying to, you know, splashing around trying to grab them. But it was super embarrassing. And then I didn't get to really enjoy the rest of the day. And I was like, man, this is why I hate glasses. So I got contacts as soon as I could. But now, you know, we do vision correction. That's our focus now. So, you know, our job is making it so people don't have frustrating events like that.
Right. So when did you get your own laser vision correction?
2003. And I had it done. Actually, I was in the U.S. Army at the time. So one of the ways that I decided to pay for medical school, I chose to not go into, you know, big debt for medical school. So I did a program through the U.S. military called the Military Scholarship Program, which is kind of like ROTC. And they basically pay your tuition and then you incur a service obligation a year for year. So I had 8 years active duty in the military, and I had it done in the Army in 2003 on PRK.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah. So no more myopia.
No more myopia. Yeah.
And I guess the presbyopia hasn't hit you just yet.
Not yet. You know, I'm starting to notice it a little bit, but I don't need cheaters yet. So.
Yeah, I didn't believe in presbyopia until it happened to me. I was like, what? Yeah. What do you mean? What? But fortunately, I'm a very lucky man. Mine is 2 spherical.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
So I don't want to give that up. I really enjoy my near vision now.
Yeah.
So you finish med school. You do a residency there in Washington, D.C. at Walter Reed.
Right. That's right.
And then you decide, like, you want to do vision correction, laser vision correction primarily.
Yeah. So, you know, even coming out of residency, I knew I loved cataract surgery, actually. Yeah. And we had done a little bit of laser vision correction as military residents. I think we graduated typically with about 50 eyes of laser vision correction, which I think is more than typical. I think most civilian residencies get barely any exposure to that.
Correct.
We had done some, but it turned out that the place where I was stationed after residency was here in Texas, Fort Hood, Texas. And the main mission of Fort Hood at that time was doing laser vision correction for troops. So Fort Hood is a huge base. I think the statistic is that by landmass is like the largest military base in the world. And there's a lot of young active duty troops there and fewer retirees. So in the military, in the DOD, you know, you can access military medical treatment facilities if you're active duty, if you're a family member of active duty, or if you're a retiree. So it's different from the VA system, you're probably aware. At Fort Hood, there were fewer retirees. There's not a lot of people that retire and move to Killeen, but there were, so there are not many cataract surgeries to do. But our main thing was doing laser vision correction. And we were doing over 3,000 cases a year in our center there at Fort Hood. So I gained a ton of experience, you know, even just learning refractive surgery. It was kind of taught by word of mouth from the other military ophthalmologists that were there. I didn't have formal fellowship training in refractive, but gained a ton of hands-on experience, being put in that high volume environment. So I loved it. And that's when I really realized there, just by repetition, that I really loved refractive surgery. And you know, one of the things that was I think a meaningful inflection point in my career was when we started doing ICLs. The way that came about was, you know, as I mentioned, we're at Fort Hood, and during that time there were wars going on with Iraq and Afghanistan. So we would frequently have service members call us in Texas from overseas, and they would say, like, hey, this is my third deployment. And I'm not coming back again with glasses. So, like, put me on the schedule. Like, I'm going to be home in Texas for a couple of weeks. You need to do my laser vision correction. So remember this one instance in particular. You know, I was an Army captain at the time. And this happened with a command sergeant major, which is like the highest ranking enlisted person. And a big, strong guy, older than me. And he came in, he's like, okay, you know, we're doing my LASIK here. I'm getting ready to go back overseas. And I had to look at his corneas, and I realized he was -8 and his corneas were very thin. And I was like, I'm sorry, Sergeant Major, but, you don't qualify for laser vision correction.
Right.
And I began to fear for my own life because he feared for his, and I had to tell him no. Right. So we started looking for alternative solutions for, you know, for people like that. And so I went to the Dominican Republic and trained with Juan Baye.
Oh, great. Yeah. We had him on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. So Juan taught me how to do ICL. And then I brought that back to Fort Hood, and we started offering it to people who weren't candidates for laser vision correction for, you know, like the scenario I just described, high myopia, thin cornea, but also even, you know, abnormal topography, keratoconus. And it turned out there were a lot of people that met that criteria. So we did a ton of ICLs and published some papers on it. And, that was a really big inflection point in adding ICLs to our refractive surgery platform. So a lot of people define refractive surgery as LASIK and PRK. If you ask, like, you know, general population, what is refractive surgery? That's kind of like the beginning and the end of the definition. Of course, today we have SMILE and refractive lens exchange and refractive cataract surgery, and phakic IOLs are a big part of it too.
Yeah, I think today you have to do the whole spectrum of refractive surgery, which is obviously both corneal but also lenticular. Mm-hmm. You got everything.
Yeah, and they really go together. I mean, I think you need to be able to do both corneal refractive surgery and lens refractive surgery in order to do well at each of them. You need to be able to do both, because it's not rare we need to combine them even, or, you know, do laser vision correction enhancement on top of a premium IOL, for example. So, so yeah, absolutely. They go hand in hand.
Yeah. So while that volume must have ramped up a lot, and obviously for the patients who are the military patients, that's covered for them, so covered benefit.
Right. Yep. So, you know, they pay for it another way. Of course, they pay for it with their service and all the, you know, lots of different ways, but not in cash. And so there wasn't a financial roadblock for them to have surgery. So therefore, you know, in the demographic fit, right? So, you know, people in their, you know, 20s and 30s are often ideal candidates for these types of procedures. There was no financial disincentive. And so for that reason, and job specific reasons why it's important, you know, if you're, you know, knocking down doors or jumping in and out of foxholes, you know, your glasses can get knocked off. You can't care for contact lenses in austere environments like that. And so for all those reasons, the line was always long outside of our refractive surgery clinic to do these procedures.
For a patient who's, let's say, young, 25 years old, low myope, good corneas, good candidate for corneal laser vision correction, what's the preference there now, mostly for the military patients? Is it PRK? Is it LASIK? Is it, you know, corneal lenticular?
It's been several years since I was in the military. I would say that culturally, the most common procedure has always been PRK.
Right.
And I think that it's not necessarily because the physicians are always recommending it, but rather it's just part of what the troops have had. And so their buddy says, hey, go get PRK. That's what I had. So it's a lot of word of mouth and just culturally part of it. You know, early on, when LASIK came out, like, you know, 25 years ago, you know, there was some concern, you know, would the flap stay stable at high altitude, at G-force, and, you know, some of these different things. And, you know, many ophthalmologists like Steve Schallhorn and others have done and published great studies showing stability at altitude and G-force. And so there's really very few reasons why a soldier couldn't have LASIK even. Instead of PRK, but still, last I knew, PRK was still more commonly done. Military has been a real big leader in refractive surgery. Some of the most important studies have come out of there. A lot of SMILE is done and researched in the military population, and certainly ICLs as well. So it's really a cool environment, unique patient population, unique scenario where we can get great data to share with our colleagues and peers.
In your own practice now, where you're there, you're in San Antonio, Texas, and you have a very large practice, what's the kind of split of the patients coming to see you who get, what percent will get, let's say, LASIK, what percent PRK, what percent SMILE, what percent phakic IOLs? Let's say your average patient, you know, young patient, 20s and 30s.
Sure. So today, the most common is still LASIK. Number two is ICL, and that's increasing.
Wow.
Yeah. Number three is SMILE, and number four is PRK. I have PRK. PRK works great, but, like, it hurts, and the recovery is a little bit longer. And so just from a recovery standpoint, it's usually our last choice. We love ICLs. I've been using ICLs for a very long time. I've done thousands of them. My wife has them. Almost every doctor in my practice, either they themselves or their spouse has it. So, you know, we've done a lot of research in terms of figuring out how to size them well. And we love the benefits of ICL. You know, the vision quality is fantastic. Now with the Evo modification, you don't have to do an LPI.
Right.
So the procedure is truly reversible, which gives patients peace of mind. You know, having any kind of eye surgery, but especially an elective one, you know, patients are sometimes fearful about, well, you know, my vision's so important, of course. What if something were to go wrong, or what if there was something about it I didn't like? And so that peace of mind of reversibility and upgradability is something that resonates for a lot of our patients. And, you know, it doesn't aggravate any pre-existing dry eye, leaves the cornea otherwise intact so that, you know, when it's time to make calculations for cataract surgery, you know, there's no considerations about a post-ablation cornea. So for all those reasons, you know, we've been big ICL fans for a long time. I would say that one of the reasons it's not number one, even ahead of LASIK today, is cost.
Yeah.
But
so how'd you get over that barrier? Because that's certainly a barrier. Because when patients see me, let's say they'll be a good candidate for either corneal refractive, either LASIK, let's say, or they'll be a good candidate for the ICL. But the ICL is going to be like, gosh, my practice almost double the cost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you own and control your own ASC, you have the ability to control that cost a little bit more. You know, a lot of colleagues of mine, you know, the facility costs to do it at a third party ambulatory surgery center is so high that that's one of the things that makes it cost prohibitive. But we're actually trying to shrink the delta between and the cost as much as we can. This year, we're actually tinkering with that a little bit.
Cool.
And we're finding that the smaller we can make that gap, not unsurprisingly, more and more people are adopting ICL. So it wouldn't surprise me that in the next couple of years, it even overtakes our LASIK volume as the number one procedure.
Wow, interesting. And you've also ramped up in your practice, of course, cataract surgery, because now, I mean, that's mm-hmm. obviously part of the spectrum of refractive surgery. At what point, let's say for a refractive lens exchange, you have a younger patient, 50-year-old, plano presbyope, want something done. What do you offer?
Yeah.
Refractive lens?
I would say that you just described probably the most difficult scenario there is. So for a plano sphere presbyope,
right,
who's 20/20 or better distance, right, and they've always seen like an eagle their whole life, and their only problem is presbyopia, our most common recommendation is actually to do blended vision with LASIK.
Yeah.
So we'll treat one eye and offset them by about, you know, depending on the magnitude of accommodation they have left. But typically the sweet spot's maybe about a diopter and a quarter myopia. And then typically in the non-dominant eye, but not always, you know, we kind of test that and demonstrate it a couple different ways. But I think you were leading me towards, you know, doing offer an RLE in that environment.
Yeah,
because
I've seen it here. I don't offer it. If you're a 50-year-old who's a plano presbyope, you've got great uncorrected distance vision, I offer what you're offering, which is LASIK in one eye to give you a little bit of a monovision or blended vision.
Yeah, because we've found that even with the modern multifocal, trifocal platform, I mean, we've got some awesome IOLs today. We use them a lot, all the time in cataract surgery, and very frequently for RLE in patients who have ametropia in addition to presbyopia.
Right.
But that scenario you just described right there, found that the distance quality the virgin eye is used to is still superior to what they get in pseudophakia. And so we found they do better with a blend.
I got even a harder patient for you. Got someone who's, let's say, early to mid 50s, minus two sphere, and says, just fix my distance vision, but don't touch my near vision.
We get it all the time, especially with the cataract patients, and we're like, well, we could use this multifocal, and they're like, no, my near vision's fine, all I need you to work on my distance. I was like, yeah, but it's not so simple. We have good success using trifocal IOLs in those patients, you know. So we've, for the last several years, our most common lens has been panoptics. More recently, we're really liking Odyssey and Envy as well. So, I mean, it's great to see multiple IOLs kind of coming into the space, because I think the competition, you know, rises tides for all the boats, and just all that innovation just creates better and better lenses for our patients.
Yeah, for sure.
I love seeing the other lenses available today. And honestly, I think all three of those are very good lenses.
Yeah, I want more options, not fewer. So keep bringing on the options. I'll take them all.
Yeah.
We can tailor.
We've had good success doing a refractive lens exchange in a low myope presbyope with those IOLs. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, obviously the slam dunk one is the ones for like the higher hyperopes. Yeah. 50-year-old plus 3 or 4. That's like a very happy.
Everything's better. There's essentially no trade-off.
Everything
gets better. Like with the myopes, you have to talk about like there's some trade-off here. You know, you're going to be gaining significant, dramatically better distance vision. You might give up a little near. You're going to see some rings and halos. There's no doubt about it. We have little cards that we use that demonstrate halos around headlights.
Okay.
And we have patients initial next to that drawing that demonstrates we've talked about that ahead of time. And we say, you will see them. It's not maybe. We say, you absolutely will see these.
Right.
But what we found is that, you know, most people neuroadapt in by 6 months. It's extremely rare if someone asks for the lens to be explanted. So that coaching ahead of time gets past that side effect issue. But I think the quality of the near is actually really good with all three of those lenses I just mentioned.
For sure. And in your practice, you're also bringing in now, you're doing more glaucoma work, and you even have an oculoplastics colleague.
We do, yeah. So Brett Davies is a military colleague of mine as well. He's still active duty in the U.S. Air Force here in San Antonio. He runs the residency there. And part-time, a few times a month, he's able to come over and do some part-time work with us, oculoplastics. And he's been doing that for several years. So this is great having him. And then we do some glaucoma, not a lot. Most of the glaucoma we do is in conjunction with cataract surgery. So, you know, like MIGS and we're getting into iDose and things like that. And we do quite a bit of clinical research. So we've been working specifically with Glaukos has been the primary one we've worked with over the years with some of their various MIGS devices. We were involved in the Elios eczema study as well. So a few different MIGS, but I wouldn't say glaucoma is our focus. It's usually kind of an adjunct to something we're doing when we're treating a cataract patient.
Gotcha. Yeah, you got for an amazing spectrum of procedures there. And you also started an amazing fellowship. Tell me about your fellowship. Because we've seen a big change. Back 20 years ago when I did residency or more, it was just, there were these types of fellowships where high surgical volume and like the full spectrum of truly refractive surgery just didn't exist. It was either do a cornea fellowship and mostly take care of corneal ulcers and do PKPs,
mm-hmm.
or you just kind of had to learn LASIK on your own.
Yeah, that's right. So I think that you're absolutely right that if you wanted to get a fellowship in refractive, the avenue to that was to do a corneal fellowship. And oftentimes the refractive piece of that, as you just mentioned, was relatively little. It's probably like 90% cornea and 10% at best refractive. But there's a huge need for training in refractive surgery. And I actually think that you know, we're only scratching the surface currently of how much refractive surgery we could be doing, you know, as a profession. And I think that one of the limiting steps for growth has actually been robust training. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of nuance to refractive surgery. There's all these different procedures. And in my opinion, it's insufficient to do a weekend certification course and get an eczema or laser certificate and all of a sudden say like, oh, I can do LASIK now. That's not an expert. So I think you really need to have robust training. My fellowship is formally 1 year. I mean, you graduate after a year, but several of my fellows have chosen to stay on a second or even third year to gain more of the nuance around it. So I think it surprised people to learn, like, how could I possibly need to spend another year to learn refractive? I thought you could just do this with a weekend course, but you know, there's a lot to it. I really have loved training fellows. It's really the thing that gives me the most joy, I think, at this point in my career. So I'm doing way less surgery myself these days. It used to be that when I started, of course, I was doing 100%. I was doing it all. And then since I've brought on several fellows now, I've slowly, you know, just decreased. So I'm only doing about 15% of the surgery in the practice today. And the fellow and my associate, Lauren Libfrein, does the rest.
Well, that's great. Yeah. How many years have you been doing the fellowship for or offering it?
Just matched our fifth fellow. So yeah, I guess 5 or 6 years now. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's great. It sounds like the fellows are getting amazing surgical volume during that year.
They really are. You know, Brett Mueller was my first fellow. And I didn't really know exactly what to tell him when we started in terms of like how much volume was it going to be. I just said, what I think is you'll get to do as much as you want. And once you get tired, you know, I'll do the rest. Like, it doesn't matter. I don't think there'll be a paucity of cases for you. But what I didn't know was how the patients and referring doctors were going to accept having someone else whose name wasn't on the wall like mine is. You know, and I probably had some ego attached thinking like, oh, people are going to actually be asking for me. But what I found is like, no, the patients don't care. The patients trust you and your environment. And it was very easy to be able to have the fellows do it. And that's great for them. They get vast experience. It's fun for me. I enjoy the teaching and seeing them become very successful. So it's been great. I really enjoy it.
That's fantastic. So how did you start your fellowship? Your practice? You finished your training and you said, yeah, okay, I'm just going to hang a shingle. How did this all evolve?
So I came out of the Army having had done, you know, lots of refractive surgery. And, you know, as a pretty young surgeon at that time, I was recruited quite a bit by the, you know, the headhunters and recruiters looking for, you know, various practices that wanted to bring in a refractive surgeon. So kind of interviewed all over the place and, tried to figure out where to land. And, the first practice I landed in, awesome place, and, really learned a lot about cataract surgery, during my experience there. And it was a little tricky to fit the culture of refractive surgery in the business culture of refractive surgery into a very busy cataract practice that wasn't necessarily refractive oriented. And so spent a year there. And then, after that, I ended up doing, finally get formal training in a fellowship in refractive surgery with Stephen Slade in Houston.
Oh,
and the things that Steve and Rick Baker taught me were really more around the business development of how do you set up the business of a refractive surgery clinic? Cause I already felt pretty confident in the clinical and surgical ability, decision-making, things like that. But coming out of the military, I had no idea, you know, what a civilian medical practice was like. You know, how does insurance fit in? How do you even, what's a CPT code? You know, so like learning the business elements of insurance and, you know, non-covered services like we do in refractive surgery was really what I gained in my fellowship training there. And then as I was completing my fellowship in Houston, we started putting in the work in place to found a practice in San Antonio. And, you know, I won't bore you or anyone listening with a lot of the details, but a lot of it kind of came together through word of mouth and, you know, maybe some divine intervention with some things that just kind of happened. There's an optometry school here in San Antonio called the Rosenberg School of Optometry. It's only one of two optometry schools in the state of Texas.
Okay.
And they recognized at that time there was a need for their school to start teaching the pre and post-op care of surgery more.
Yeah.
And what they kind of realized is that as an optometrist, there's a lot of pressures. If you're just in the business of doing retail optometry, selling glasses and contacts, there was a lot of pressure with 1-800 contacts, things like Warby Parker.
For sure.
And so the school identified that they needed to transition to more of a service-oriented profession, and learning how to do pre- and post-op care of common things like cataract surgery and LASIK was one of the ways that they could provide more of a service, more less so retail. So they were keen to have an ophthalmologist that would be willing to teach pre- and post-op care of the surgery, and we were able to come in and actually start the practice inside of the optometry school clinic.
Oh, wow.
We opened up in about 5,000 square feet, put a laser center in there, Now, I do want to clarify, I didn't and wasn't and have not taught any optometrists how to do surgery itself. But we did think it's really beneficial for them to learn to not be afraid of these surgeries and know when to recommend them to their patients and know how to talk about the various surgeries beforehand and manage the patients postoperatively. And from a division of labor perspective, especially with all the demographics of our patients, we're going to really need ophthalmologists and optometrists that know how to work together and do really good quality co-management to deliver the outcomes to our patients that they expect. And so that's what we started doing. And there was also a large community of optometrists in our community that wanted to support this, and so referred patients for cataract surgery and research studies and refractive surgery, and that model kind of grew. So we started in 2013, and then by 2019 we moved from 5,000 square feet into where we now inhabit, which is 40,000 square feet with an on-site AS 3-room OR and 12 total doctors, optometrists, ophthalmologists, optometric resident, the ophthalmology fellow, as I mentioned. So it's a very collaborative, everybody's on an even field. It's not hierarchical. The MDs and the ODs have a lot of respect for each other and kind of recognize the skill set that each brings to the equation. And we truly work together to deliver a care experience to our patients. So it's a fun environment.
Well, that's amazing growth in about what, like a dozen years.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. I see the output, but the input to achieve that is so much work. Oh my gosh. You have probably been working nonstop for a dozen years then.
It's a lot of work by a lot of people.
It's a great team for sure.
Yeah. And yes, I've put a lot of work in, and at the same time, I absolutely couldn't have done it without some really key individuals along the way that have, come along and helped us do this. So yeah, absolutely team effort.
Tell me about the name. I actually like the name New Vision there, the NU and Vision. How do you think of this? What did that come from?
So that wasn't my idea. That existed before I came here. I mentioned the group of optometrists in the community that were supporting the practice with surgical referrals. They had referred them. They referred to themselves as New Vision before. So when we kind of came in together and we added my name as the surgeon, and they were still New Vision as the optometrist, and so that's where that name kind of developed from.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it's catchy. it's really catchy. Now, in the U.S., we've kind of just seen a little like a stagnation of corneal refractive surgical volume over the last 20 years. Why is that? Why don't we have better penetration of this?
Gosh, I mean, I think that's a huge topic, Uday. And I think that there's many things that have led to that. I mentioned one a few minutes ago. I think really high quality training has been a limiter to growth of the specialty. We need to have a near zero complication rate in this specialty. Again, our eyes are so precious. Most people rank their vision as their most precious sense.
Of course.
And doing elective surgery is such a huge responsibility. It's really emotional for patients. People will often report having refractive surgery is one of the top five most memorable things in their life, right up there with getting married and having kids. It's like, our vision is so emotional to us. So it needs to be nearly perfect, nearly all of the time, because one little issue, even with a very small number of patients, can cause more fear with the rest of the community. So I think the way that we can accomplish that super high bar is to have really good, robust training. So that is certainly one of the things that I think is important. And, I'm really proud of the fellowship we have here, but there are now several others that have cropped up over the last decade or so where you can go spend a year or sometimes more if you want, really diving into all the nuance of refractive surgery. A lot of it goes beyond the technical and clinical skill of procedure selection and, diagnostic interpretation, surgical technique. a lot of it, interestingly enough, is actually some psychology of how to identify the right patients and how to give them proper expectations preoperatively, when to say no, you know, how to manage patients that, that have absolutely treatable short-term issues post-operatively to keep them from, you know, getting really upset. So there's plenty of psychology that goes into the technical surgical skill.
Because you would think that, like, for your own kids, when they turn 12 or something, when they may get braces to straighten their teeth out. And if they end up being myopic, then when they're 20 years old, they may get LASIK surgery. It seems so logical to just say, why not enjoy those amazing years of life without being burdened by glass and contacts?
Yeah. It's true. I mean, we don't often see patients in here that are, you know, 18, 19, 20 years old. Although I did ICLs on my 18-year-old son this past summer.
Well, there you go.
So that, I mean, that makes your point right there. Like, it's like, if you know, like, this is the time to do it. But a lot of people don't know that. So when we do see those 18, 19, 20 year olds come in and they're like, hey, I think I'm ready for LASIK now. We're kind of like, I always tell them, I was like, you are the smartest person in the building today, because most people don't realize this is the best age to do it. And, you know, surely you can have a great outcome at age 35, but you just wasted the last 15 years that you could have been really enjoying the benefits of this. So, absolutely. I mean, I think that, there's a lot of benefits to doing it, doing these procedures in younger patients. So the tricky thing though, goes back to economics. So the patient, the 18, 19, 20 year olds that can often benefit the most are the ones that can't pay for it. I mean, they're still in school, they're still in college. Like, how are they supposed to pay a few thousand bucks to get their eyes treated? Right. So invariably the patients who can afford it are the ones like you just described, the 50-year-old Plano presbyopes.
Right.
Those are the ones that can afford it, but the value proposition is a little bit different. It's like the nuance of what can we do for this different problem at this different age is a little different. So, gosh, I mean, we could talk about this topic here for a couple hours. There's a lot to it. Everything from, you know, like education piece of the surgeons, but even education of the community, you know, who's talking to the parents of teenage athletes that says like, yeah, let's do these contacts playing football while they're 16. But, you know, by 20, let's get them a graduation present and, you know, get them, you know, so like, I think the refractive surgeons often don't have the audience of the parents of myopes when that education piece ought to start happening.
Because, I mean, in the last 20 years in the U.S., the incidence of myopia has just kept going up and up and up and up. Now, especially where every two-year-old you see, you go out to the have dinner, you see a little two-year-old playing on a phone, two years old, right?
Yeah.
So these are for sure. You get that all that near stimulus, you're going to have a generation of even more myopic kids.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a study published in Ophthalmology a couple years ago that projects half the world's population will have myopia by the year 2050. And so there's a huge increase, in certain populations more than others. Like, well, you know, in Asia, it's like everybody, 90% of the population has myopia. It's a big problem. It's not going away. It's only getting worse. And so one of the other anecdotes we talked a little bit about, you know, like doing these procedures on younger patients, that was the population we treated in the military. It was quite common. We were treating 18, 19, 20 year olds. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, we didn't see them coming back at age 25, having regressed into two diopters of myopia. So like, I actually believe this is not proven, but my suspicion is that there's something preventive of myopia progression if you treat it at a younger age. I think that's something that could be borne out. Because otherwise you'd think like, oh, there's myopia is still worsening up until early 20s. We often don't see that in the young patients who get treated.
No, for sure. But and then even it could be a great college graduation present. If you want to even wait till you're 22 and you're done with your bachelor's degree, great time to do it. Because then, as you said, now you can enjoy it from 22 until like 48 or 50 become presbyopic of like a totally glasses-free lifestyle, which is which would be something amazing. But yeah, the crazy part is, yeah, we just haven't seen that increased volume. Yeah. I think one of the issues could even be there's a lot of misinformation out there. People are so scared. And that one story about one patient gets sensationalized and like just dings the whole ship.
Yeah. Yeah, we need somebody like Taylor Swift to like redo her 22 song and talk about like LASIK at 22. That would have been a good one.
I don't know the song, but I'm sure we have a good spokesperson like that. That'd be amazing, I'm sure. But I think that's one of the challenges here, right? And obviously, you've voted with your own family's eyes, right? I'm sure you've done procedure for your kid, your mom, your dad,
everybody. Your wife. Everybody who's needed it. Yep. So I had PRK. My wife has ICLs. 18-year-old son has ICLs. My mom, we did blended vision LASIK. My dad's had trifocal IOLs, early cataract surgery, premium cataract surgery. So yeah, everybody's not wearing glasses anymore.
Yeah, it's a neat thing. So I guess we'll time will tell. But I think, yeah, with the increasing of myopia, the increased incidence there, it's just such a huge demand. Mm-hmm. But I just know, like, even like me, I could do more volume now. So I mean, I certainly have bandwidth to do more volume. We just got to get the patients in the door and have them convinced of it. But it's not such an easy task.
I think that part of it too is reframing the conversation of price to a monthly financed amount. That's just switching, you know, what you're spending on a monthly or yearly basis on your glasses and contacts, and just like switching that monthly or annual amount towards a financed procedure. And then the beauty is, you've paid for it in, you know, 3 or 4 years usually, and then it stops. Because I think right now the patients often hear like the top line price, that's this big lump sum up front, and they're like, whoa, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it in terms of the financial savings that you get, because it's not like you're spending nothing on your bad vision now. You know, you're spending money every month on disposable contact lenses and probably a backup pair of glasses or two. I think framing it so people understand that this could actually save them in the long run, instead of like, wow, that's a lot of money today, is again part of the psychology that's necessary, I think, for people to fully get it.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense, because if you're from ages 20 to and beyond, you're going to be paying for the glasses, a couple pair a year. You pay for the contacts, maybe some solutions, whatever. It's going to add up for sure. And this is a one-time cost, but I like the idea of reframing it. Instead of saying, here's the big lump sum up front, which for a young person can be like daunting.
Yeah.
Say, no, it's just shifting the way you spend. And by the way, hey, you only got to do it for a couple of years, then it's paid for. Whereas the glass tonics, you're going to do for decades.
Yeah. Yeah. And then most of the Gen Zers and even millennials as well, like they're used to doing the prescription model for almost everything. Like same thing, think about like your phone. Like I have no idea how much my actual phone cost. Because AT&T just bundles it into my monthly amount according to my plan. I know the device actually costs something, but I don't know what it is. I just know what I pay per month. So same thing here.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense for sure. So hopefully we'll get more programs like yours, these newer type fellowships that are so refractive surgery focused. I know there's been a big push also, the World College of Refractive Surgery and Visual Sciences. That's a neat organization.
Yeah.
And that's again trying to have set standards of this is what the standard of the training is. I think that should help too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think standardized training is really necessary. And one of the things the World College is trying to do is model the training environment after the aviation industry, where like, you know, everybody needs to be checked off on these same things, so that, you know, if you go for LASIK in Los Angeles, you're going to get the same quality in terms of like you can trust your surgeon, just like you can trust your pilot flying the 747. Is trained on all the necessary equipment, all the necessary technology to make a safe outcome. And that's something that we just really have not had in refractive surgery to date. Of course, we have board certification in ophthalmology and our residencies are certified. But like, as we were talking earlier, you know, when Brett Mueller looked at this a couple years ago, and the median number of laser vision correction procedures performed by graduating U.S. residents was zero. The median number was zero.
Median, for sure.
Yeah, and the requirements. If you look at the ACGME requirements to graduate ophthalmology residency, is to perform or observe, and those two words are important. Perform or observe 6 corneal refractive procedures of which an LRI counts. So you could watch your attending do six LRIs and you're checked off to do refractive surgery. This is crazy. You need a lot more than that. So standards and training, I think, is going to be one of the things that'll really help. Allow refractive surgery to achieve its full potential.
Yeah, I think so. But yeah, the ACGME standards is, I had a video on cataract coaching. The cataract number for residents is like, I don't know, 80 something. Mm-hmm. That's a very small number. And that's, I don't know how many of those are observe versus perform or assist.
Yeah.
But it's, obviously you need more hands on there. But I think your program like yours is going to really change the way this is being done. And we see more and more of these fellowships in the last 5 years. I think a lot have popped up.
That's right. Yeah.
Which I think is fantastic.
We typically have about 50 applicants for our one spot. Wow. So, I mean, that tells you like the demand versus supply mismatch. There's not enough places that do the training. There's a lot of people who want to get it.
Wow. So, I didn't realize that much. How do you choose that? Out of 50, I wouldn't even know how to choose.
Yeah. I mean, it's a process, right? I mean, you look at the letters, you look at the, you know, for anyone who's applying next year, I'll tell you a secret.
Sure.
The first thing I look at on every application is the personal statement. I read the personal statement. I was like, does this person really want to do refractive surgery or are they interested in cornea? Because we're not cornea. I want to train someone who wants to be trained in what we teach here. So that actually weeded out quite a few of them. And then once I realized, okay, this batch actually wants to learn refractive, then, you know, the traditional stuff, you go to letters and scores and then we host a couple interview dates. So we'll typically interview about 10 people in person. We require an in-person interview. You know, the last couple of years, a lot of it's been done by, you know, video conference like this, but we like to be able to like meet people in person for such an important decision. Like, who are we going to spend the next year with? And then the last thing we do is we ask them to send surgical videos from doing cataract surgery.
Oh, yeah. I love that. Mm-hmm. That's a great idea. What do you look for in the cataract surgery?
You know, it's amazing how quickly you can tell. I mean, you probably know this with all the residents you've trained over the years. I think you can tell someone who's got pretty good hands versus someone who needs a lot more training. You know, within the first few seconds of watching the video, I mean, even just like making the incisions, you can already tell. So, and then the other thing to see is like, you know, presumably these videos are like the best there is. Those are the ones they chose to send. So you kind of think about like, okay, well, this is like as good as it gets.
Of course, the cherry picked.
Yeah, how far do we have to go from here? And so sometimes that can make a difference because you know, in a high volume place like ours, you know, and the requirements that like there's a near zero complication rate, like we have to hit the ground running with surgical skill and then treat the nuance. And having adequate cataract surgery skills is important.
Oh, I think I love the idea of asking for a video because you can tell right away. You can see what they've learned and how they move their hands, even simple things. How's the draping? Does the eye stay in primary? Let me say you made that incision. The little details tell a lot. And I think it's important to have someone who's has the enthusiasm for learning. You know, someone who wants to be that sponge, it's going to be happy about, like, you know, doing an extra case.
100%. Yep. So we try to be real clear that, you know, our program is high volume. It's not necessarily long hours. We're just real efficient about it. But you got to be ready to and want to do a lot of surgery to be happy in our program. And, you know, so it's kind of like this matchmaking problem. I mean, because there's people that want something else. And, we want to try to find the right fit so that everybody's successful.
Yeah, when I was interviewing, I did academics half-time for about 22 years. Stopped doing that a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But my favorite questions for interviewing residency applicants was, just only had two questions. One was, tell me something you taught yourself outside of medicine in the last few years. Mm-hmm. Like, can you teach yourself?
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I actually learned to play guitar. Or ukulele. I picked it up by watching YouTube videos I like. Yeah. Second is, I would just say, describe me, what would be your perfect day of residency? Like, you're a senior resident, describe me that perfect day. Well, you better describe our program. Hello, because that's all we got to offer.
Right. Right. So yeah, those are good. Yeah, I like those. I'm gonna steal those, Uday.
Yeah, those are. I mean, to me, that's only two questions. That's it.
Yeah.
Because we did very brief interviews because all the faculty wanted to interview. So we ended up doing was, I think each applicant would do 10 or 12 interviews, each lasting like just 10, 15 minutes, like quick. Mm-hmm. So we could get to meet everyone.
Yeah. It's hard. It's not a lot of time to get to know someone. And, you know, maybe it's like a 15 minute interview or something like that. But you know, I've been super lucky. You know, I've had some of the most amazing fellows. I'm so proud of everything that they're doing, and they teach me stuff. I mean, they're just awesome.
What kind of volume will they get in a year? What are the numbers?
Oh gosh, they'll do well over 1,000 cataracts.
Wow, 20 a week. That's a clip.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, so what I've told them, my judge of have they been sufficiently trained in cataract surgery is if they can execute a 40 surgery a day by themselves with no assistance. If they can do 40 in a day, I've trained them to the point they're ready. So that's how I measure, like, did they meet the mark? And so, yeah, they do a lot of cataract surgery, and then a similar number of refractive all included. So that's usually going to be, you know, a couple hundred ICLs, a few hundred LASIK, 50 SMILE, something like that.
Greg, tell me about the work you're doing with your foundation.
Yeah, so the Visual Freedom Foundation is something I'm really excited about. And this is a program where we're trying to reach people in the developing world that were born with severe refractive errors that have never had the opportunity to even get a pair of glasses. Certainly they don't have the infrastructure to get contact lenses. You know, there's many different charities out there. I've participated in some of them. I know you have too, where you can deliver cataract surgery in the developing world. And those are awesome. However, the unmet need that exists is, let's say, young working force people with severe myopia. You know, you're just as blind if you're minus 15 with no glasses or contacts as you are if you have a 4+ nuclear sclerotic cataract. And so one of the things the Visual Freedom Foundation is finding ways to address those people around the world. And so we're doing that in a few different ways. One is through a program called Focus on Independence, which is something that Dan Dury started. And this is a program that any refractive surgeon can get involved in. I mean, it's simple. All you have to do is just do it. And it's doing free refractive surgery for patients that have suffered spinal cord injuries. So I got the opportunity to treat a patient a couple years ago, a super nice lady who had an unfortunate accident where she fell off her horse and fractured her neck. And so she was confined to a wheelchair and had no use of her legs or her hands and had myopia. So, you know, she didn't have a way to take glasses on and off or certainly put contacts in and out anymore. So patients like that can really benefit from having refractive surgery so that, you know, there's one more thing they don't have to think about is like, how am I going to see today? And so Focus on Independence is designed to reach that community of people that either had a spinal cord injury, or there's a couple instances of people that were, you know, born without use of their hands for various reasons. So that's one of the initiatives. And another one we call Eye to Eye, and we've been doing that here at my practice for several years. And it's kind of like the Tom's Shoes model, where everybody who has refractive surgery in our private clinic, we either perform or fund a surgery in the developing world one for one. Another way that and patients get really excited about that too, because like they're happy that they're contributing as well to treat somebody in you know, around the world that, you know, has no other option. And we're also looking at ways to even build some clinics in parts of the world that haven't had infrastructure. So Visual Freedom Foundation is what it's called. You can find it online. We'll drop the link here. But we invite any refractive surgeon that would like to join with us, basically delivering refractive surgery to people in need and doing it pro bono.
That sounds like a fantastic outreach. That is really great. Yeah, some people don't realize that. I didn't realize that Cataract obviously is the very common worldwide cause of vision loss, but refractive error is even bigger problem.
It is. Yeah, there's more people that are blind from untreated refractive error than there are from cataracts.
Yeah. Wow, that's, and then you can, I guess for these patients, you can offer the full spectrum, right? Whether it be ICL for the minus 15 or LASIK or even IOL surgery, let's say a, you know, full range multifocal IOL for the patient.
You can, yep. There's nothing stopping us from using any technology other than our time and our willingness to contribute. So, yeah, well, so it's something that's really
important. I'll drop the link below.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Wow. Now, but let me just switch gears for a sec. Talking about SMILE or corneal, you know, lenticule extraction. Mm-hmm. I went to visit other surgeons in other countries. I was in Zagreb, Croatia, and I had a surgeon who just basically, for any mild, just doesn't ever do LASIK. Just all, and they're using different lasers that arguably we don't have here. They're using Schwinn lasers, which are amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some limitations to not only the various platforms, but even what's open to us, you know, through the Zeiss platform here in the U.S. There, you know, the FDA has things that, you know, they can turn on over there that we can't turn on here. So there are some limitations in terms of how high you go, how low you go, how much SIL, you know, dealing with cyclorotation. You know, there's lots of considerations. It's a great procedure. And, you know, we've got so much amazing technology. It really is surprising that there's not more people having these procedures than there are. When you look at even things like topography guided ablations with platforms like Contour and things like that. I mean, you can like smooth out an irregular cornea and give people significantly better uncorrected vision than their best corrected vision was. I remember like years ago, we used to say like, well, the goal with this surgery is to get you to see about as well as you do with your glasses. It shouldn't be really better. It should be probably close to the same as you do with your glasses. Now it's common. They see objectively better uncorrected postoperatively than their best corrected was in their spectacles. So like we're actually improving best corrected vision, which is just an incredible advancement in the technology that we've seen over the last, you know, two, three decades. It's still really fun. And I think the future is going to be even way more fun than what I've experienced in my career so far.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think it's going to keep evolving. The new stuff that's coming. I mean, I've seen previews of it because I travel a ton. I lectured in 21 countries last year. So I really traveled a lot. Wow, crazy year. But yeah, I just was amazed by some of these newer technologies, and hopefully they'll kind of trickle their way into the U.S. And I think we'll have more and more options for patients. Mm-hmm. And hopefully by the time I need an IOL, I'm hoping for some real accommodation.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah.
Working hard on that project. But now, what a fantastic conversation. I can't believe an hour's gone by already. really enjoyed this, but I'll definitely encourage our young viewers and listeners, check out your practice, see what it's all about. If you're a resident right now, a lot of residents listen to our podcast, certainly look into your fellowship. And now you already know what he's going to look for. Make sure that personal statement's on point.
Yeah.
No, great stuff. Well, again, thank you so much. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, I got a new podcast every single Sunday. It's on Amazon, Apple, Spotify, Google, anywhere you find your podcast, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. Plus, remember, we now have a sister channel, retinarounds.com. It is available right now. Check it out, as well as the YouTube channel, new retina video every day. And of course, we still have a new Cataract Coach video every single day. So until next time, I'll check you later.